The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
I'm joined in studio by Britain's ambassador to Ireland, Paul Johnston. Paul, you're very welcome to the show, and it's good to talk to you. Can I ask you first about Israel? So this week, Benjamin Netanyahu had this security cabinet meeting wherein he talked about the full occupation of Gaza, and how a lot of people are interpreting this is the official abandonment of the two-state solution from an Israeli point of view. Is that how you would assess the direction of travel we're on?
Good afternoon, Kieran. It's been no secret that the Israeli government and Netanyahu have been sceptical about, even opposed to, a two-state solution. The British government, in common with, you know, the whole of Europe, the whole of the international community, has been committed to a two-state solution, even when the hope has looked very, very slight. We've done so because we think it's the only sustainable solution for the region. You have to have peace and security for the people of Israel, but you'll only get that, in our firm conviction, if you have peace and security and recognition and statehood for the Palestinian people. And that's why Keir Starmer has decided that we will recognise Palestine unless Israel takes some really meaningful steps in the next few weeks, which would unblock the road to a two-state solution, which includes ending the crisis in Gaza, making sure there's aid delivery, cooperating on a political process. And we see very little progress at the moment in that direction. If anything, as you say, the signs are going backwards. So the step that we will take will be as part of this wider international effort about, I would say, keeping alive the hope of a two-state solution, because we firmly believe there is no other long-term sustainable alternative.
Why is the recognition of a Palestinian state kind of, I wouldn't say so far down the agenda, but from a kind of a timeline point of view, down the agenda in terms of getting to the point of a two-state solution? You know, there's an interpretation of the Oslo Accords, which is where this, the kind of the current iteration of a two-state solution is born of, that would say, you know, the first thing we should do is recognize a state, a Palestinian state, and then work from there.
And there's an opposing view, which you hear sometimes, including in British political circles, which says it's not meaningful to recognise a Palestine state because none of the normal conditions for statehood are really recognised. It's not an authority with control over all its territory. There isn't a defined population, etc., etc. I think our view has always been that we would recognise a Palestinian state at the moment that we thought it would have maximum impact or maximum utility in, you know, what passes for a peace process. And the judgment we've reached in the last few weeks is that things have come to such a stage. I think I said in an article in The Independent, you know, the peace process is on life support and something needs to be done to jolt it into life. Now, we have no sort of illusion that our step on its own will tilt the balance any more than what Ireland did with Spain and Norway last year would. But I think it's an important contribution. France and Canada are committing to the same step. So we have a large majority of members of the UN General Assembly now recognising Palestine. And I think it is, in a way, you know, there's some people say it's a gesture, but I think it's a meaningful gesture, and it has to be part of a wider plan to address the desperate humanitarian crisis and to, in a way, address the no less desperate political situation.
There's an argument that would suggest that the two-state solution, as we understand it up until a few years ago, you know, was no longer viable, kind of, even, you know, pre-October 7th, pre the war in Gaza, and largely because of Israeli settlements in the West Bank, that had actually undermined the two-state solution.
And indeed, one of the criteria that we've put on the Israeli government, if you like, for the avoidance of recognition, is that there must be a commitment for no further annexation, no further illegal settlement activity. I think, to me, the paradox of this is that you have the definition, the parameters of a two-state solution in terms of successive UN resolutions being very clear that the occupied territories need to form the basis of a future Palestinian state. It's clearly been Israel's policy over time to reduce the practical viability of that. All of that would need to be taken into account in a sort of final status negotiation, status of Jerusalem, all these other issues. But I think, in a way, if we're getting into that sort of discussion, I wouldn't use the term problem of success, but we're already at a much more advanced stage than we are now. So I think we need to keep pushing for the principle of relaunching a meaningful process. And then it will be for the parties to decide exactly what that means in terms of territory and boundaries.
You used the word paradoxical there. Is it a slightly oxymoronic position to attach the conditions that have been attached by the British government, in the sense that if they were to be met by Israel, then Keir Starmer's government would not recognise the state of Palestine? But the implication of Israel doing that would be that we are on the road to recognising the state of Palestine.
I think what we thought, the judgment was, you could simply play, I don't want to use the word play the recognition card because that makes it sound trivial, but you could make this decision now and it would land, but you wouldn't be, in a sense, making it a contribution to something. If you wanted to test the willingness of the Israeli government to look at a diplomatic solution, you would say, we're going to do this unless. Now, all this of evidence so far is that those criteria are unlikely to be met. Mm. If they were to be met, you could argue it's a good thing either way, because you're either building momentum internationally for progress towards a two-state solution, or you're getting the Israeli government finally to do something that which improves the situation on the ground and which improves the prospects of launching a peace process. So I think that was the logic behind attaching this sort of conditionality, if you like, to it.
Our focus on the recognition of the state of Palestine, it betrays a certain kind of Eurocentric view of the world, doesn't it? I mean, the overwhelming majority of countries on the planet recognise the state of Palestine.
Exactly. And I remember when I was our ambassador to the EU for foreign and security policy, one of the really difficult issues was always the Israel-Palestine question, because you had those states who had, for various reasons, one wouldn't necessarily say sympathy towards Israel, but were more inclined to look at the Israel security and historical argument. You had states who were instinctively very sympathetic towards the Palestinian cause. You had, I would say, states like us in the middle trying to sort of form a balanced view. But as you see in UN votes, that the EU used to vote in three different, positions. And I think that has reduced the coherence of European and wider international effectiveness. But you're right, in some ways you could argue it's the narcissism of small differences. On the other hand, the fact that, people have welcomed it and other people have criticised it, it shows that it's not a meaningless move. And clearly, Israel was very opposed to Ireland's recognition last year, withdrew their ambassador. They've criticised what we're doing. We're convinced that it's the right thing to do in an extremely difficult situation where there are no obvious positive avenues. But we've thought long and hard about it and decided that this was the right moment to take this particular step.
You used a phrase that you talked about, a distinct European position. And I want to ask you about European positions with regard to transatlantic trade. I guess there was a focus on the detail of what was agreed at Turnberry, or the lack of detail, rather. But there was also commentary on the way it came about, that Ursula von der Leyen may be kind of carving out a more executive role for the president of the European Commission than previous presidents had in the past. Do you see, as a consequence of what is happening, the realignment of global trade and the kind of the reprioritization of issues in the United States and a more internal view of things, that Europe, or a more coherent European foreign policy, will emerge?
So I think, as a representative of a country that's no longer a member of the European Union, it's not for me to comment directly on that. But I think there is a wider sort of European perspective here. I think even before the new American administration came in, wider, if you like, geopolitical factors to do with China, to do with other challenges, had made the EU, as I understand it, and certainly the UK, look at issues of free trade in, if you like, a more nuanced way, no longer believing, as we'd maybe rather naively done in the sort of 90s and the noughties, that the world would just get generally more prosperous through the unqualified expansion of
the end of history.
Global free trade. Yes, the end of history and the end of protectionism. And I think whether you call it economic security or reshoring or a focus on supply chains and resilience, there was a sense that as you look to the economy of the future, we could no longer sort of simply imagine that we could import stuff and there'd be more of a case for making stuff at home or having more a narrower set of trusted partners. And I think that has obviously been a theme that's been developed at greater speed over the last few months. So I think there is a recognition now, as we look at our modern industrial strategy, A, that we need a more functional relationship with the European Union, hence the deal we reached in May, but also that we need to be thinking about the international economy in a different way. You asked about a more coherent European position. I think one of the things that's been very positive in the last few months in the terrible tragedy of Ukraine is that Britain and France and Britain and Europe more widely have tried to bring sort of leadership and coherence and both our support for Ukraine, but also an attempt to influence the wider diplomacy. And I think one of the things that we'll see coming out of the UK-EU summit is more structured cooperation between the two of us on foreign and security policy, because we have such deep shared values and interests. I think it is probably a wider reflection that, you know, we know that the EU's and Europe's share of global trade in the global economy is less than it was and is probably on a long-term declining path. I don't think Europe as such needs to resign itself to declining global influence. In fact, you could argue in terms of multilateralism and a whole range of issues, a more coherent European voice, which is obviously for the EU internally to shape, but for like-minded partners like ourselves to work with, is more needed than ever. And you have this new-ish, it's not an institution, but the network of the European political community, which Ireland will chair a big summit of next year during the Irish EU presidency, I think nearly 50 countries. And that's a sort of grouping which is informal, but has proved to be quite a useful place for getting together to discuss foreign policy challenges, but also wider security challenges, including illegal immigration, which is a pressing political and security issue for many countries. So, long way of saying, I think out of these various aspects of the current, you know, broad international crisis we face, I do see a more coherent European approach to things, as well as the need for a continuing strong transatlantic relationship, which you hear from EU leaders and you hear from my government as well. I don't think there's a contradiction between the two. I think they need to be articulated carefully. But the revitalisation of NATO is also part of that strong transatlantic bond.
Well, what issue then finally do you suspect will define UK-Irish relations over the next decade?
I think in a way, my hope has been for some time that the period that we've been for most of my 5 years here, which was sort of still dealing with the aftermath of Brexit, still dealing with the aftermath of the Troubles, will move on to something in which, in a way, we'll be working together to confront some broader challenges, but also looking at some shared opportunities, things like renewable energy, how do we make the most of AI, thinking about skills and education, how do we turn the common travel area into a common talent area? There's a range of positive policy and commercial opportunities that we discussed at the bilateral summit, the UK-Irish summit back in March, where I think we will now have, notwithstanding all the other crises and things we'll have to deal with, we'll have an opportunity to pursue a broader, more positive agenda and move out of the sort of crisis management phase that we've been in for much of the last 5 or 10 years.
Right, we'll leave it on that note. Paul Johnson, who is the British ambassador to Ireland. Paul, thank you as always for joining us here on the show.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.